In this hour of Focus 580, we have here in the studio as our guest Scott Tinker. He is director of the Bureau of Economic Geology, which is based for Texas and is based at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also the state geologist of Texas, and he is a professor of geology at University of Texas, Austin. He is someone who has a lot of experience in the area of petroleum geology, and in fact, one of his jobs for a number of years was working as a geologist at the Petroleum Technology Center of Marathon Oil, based in Littleton, Colorado. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, part of a series of talks that has been going on and will continue over the next couple of months that mark the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. He gave a talk yesterday, gave one this morning, and there's another coming up that I just want to mention in case people would like to go and hear him talking about business ethics. The I in business ethics is the topic, and he'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in room 228 of the Natural History Building, which is on West Green in Urbana, and I'm sure that it's open to anybody who was interested in hearing him. Questions also here on the program are welcome, I thought, because just recently the president gave his State of the Union address, and a lot of that was devoted to discussion of energy. And given his background in petroleum geology, I thought perhaps we could spend a little bit of time talking about that, talking about energy policy here in the United States. And questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call into this show, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Appreciate it. As I'm sure people know, energy was a very significant part of the State of the Union address. And President Bush said something that I imagine probably a lot of other people would agree with, but it's not something that he has said before when he made his now famous and oft-quoted statement that America is addicted to oil. And he went on to talk about a number of things, including the need for alternatives and renewables, his desire to reduce our dependence on imported sources of oil, increased use of coal and so forth. Let me ask you one thing, and I know that this is something that is much debated in circles of geologists and people who track energy and so forth, and that's about peak oil. Some people feel that we have either passed or are close to the peak of oil production for the world. And probably the guy that's often referenced is the man who wrote the book about M. King Hubbard, who famously predicted the peak of U.S. oil production and then went on also to predict the peak of world oil production. And I know this is something that there are different ideas about. People argue about this. Some people say yes. Some people say no. What is your take on peak oil?
It's a good question. I actually got to chair a symposium in Washington, D.C. last October, and the topic was peak oil. So we invited some of the a good spread of experts from around the world, some that we call early peakers, which think it is going to happen or has happened, and others that have a longer sort of view on that. Matt Simmons is one of the kind of leading folks on thinking that oil has or will soon peak. And he's published a book called Twilight in the Desert, which is looking at Saudi Arabian production and the reality of how long they can sustain production, et cetera. So I think it's important to make clear two things in that area. One is when we talk about oil, there are lots of kinds. Mm-hmm. And largely what we're talking about and with the production of oil in a peak is conventional oil. My father worked at Shell Bel Air with King Hubbard in those years and knew him, and he did a good job of forecasting that timing. What Hubbard missed was the shape of the decline. He sort of predicted that it would be a rise and a fall, much like a bell-shaped curve. And in fact, it's been a bumpy mesa, a real slow undulating plateau or whatever description you want to use for the decline in the production of oil in the U.S. So globally, you probably see a very similar kind of thing happen. Is we'll hit a peak, and it may be now or maybe in a few years from now, and a very slow production decline of conventional oil.
Hmm.
What's exciting about oil, though, is it's also found in but when I say conventional, I mean oil that's in a liquid form that's produced in reservoirs.
The kind when people think you drill an oil, you go down there, oil in a liquid form comes gushing up.
Scooting up.
Right.
And at certain pressures it does, and then when those pressures decline, you put a pump jack that you see on the surface to pump it up. But there's oil found in shales. There's oil found in tar sands. And there's oil that can be produced from very heavy forms and sources that haven't been economic historically, and you can even liquefy coal. So we call these unconventional forms of oil, and there's a tremendous world resource of those. And when prices get high, like they are now, it opens up new technology and new opportunity for investment to try to produce some of those less conventional forms of oil. And those are not part of the discussion when people talk about peak oil. So those are really the next wedge, if you will, of oil production, because whether we like it or not, the transportation industry is dominated by liquid fuels.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then, if you sort of for a moment, if you separate those two things out, if you take conventional oil and then these other forms, that's where the oil is there, but it's more difficult and more expensive to get. And again, they'll look at the question of peak. Do you think that as far as conventional oil is concerned, are we somewhere around the peak of production, do you think?
We're at a flat spot. You know, I think we've probably come to the top of the mesa, if you will, and we're going to float along on the top for probably 10 to 20 years. I go to the Middle East quite often, and there are tremendous reserves there that only have one or two wells in them. They've just been tested by the well and ready to be developed. Countries that have been in economic strife for a while, Iraq being one of them, have upsides that we haven't reached yet. And so we're probably at a plateau point in terms of our production. But that's very significant because demand continues to increase globally. Mm-hmm. As the Far East industrializes, there's a strong demand pull, if you will, and a craving for oil. So I say to folks, the Middle East, if they're looking north, they used to only look left for markets, and they had to respond to the Western push for production. They can look right now, and there are markets right across the Indian Ocean in China and India for oil. And so I had dinner with the Secretary of OPEC last fall, and he explained that you could produce oil, say 10 million barrels a day, which is about the production in Saudi Arabia today, at $60 a barrel. If you accelerated production to 15 million barrels a day, price may fall to $40 a barrel. The gross revenue is the same, only they're producing their reserve sooner. And now that there are two markets that are competing for the oil, they're a lot less inclined to respond to Western pressure to increase production of conventional oil. And that's a real market shift. That's a global market shift today in that demand. So demand is pulling price up, and you see markets that are more competitive for oil now than they were in the 70s when the other big shock happened.
Well, if you then turn to talk a little bit about the unconventional sources, the tar sand and oil shale and those kinds of things, and let's say we restrict ourselves to resources in North America, because there's particularly this focus on domestic sources. So if we include, I hope folks in Canada won't mind if I grab their resource too. So say we're talking about resources in North America, so the United States, Canada, and into Alaska. What does anybody think might be here in terms of these unconventional sources? How much oil would be there available for exploitation, assuming that you can justify what it costs to get it?
Yeah, that's a good question. The, and you include Mexico, even in North America.
Sure.
It's often said that, North America is sort of the Saudi Arabia of unconventional oil. So interestingly, one of the largest tar sand deposits in the world is in Canada, the Athabasca tar sand system. The greatest known resources of shale oils are in the western United States, in the shale basins out west of the Rocky Mountains. We have some heavy oil resource, but those are more prominent as you go south, particularly Venezuela and areas like that. And then we have a huge coal resource which can be liquefied with certain processes, technologies that are known. So if you look at heavy oil or shale oil, tar sands, and coal liquefaction, we have the greatest global resource of those three fuels. And it makes great sense to kind of pursue strategies that can produce those and then try to do them in a more environmentally friendly way than we would have done 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And those technologies exist. It's going to take quite a bit of investment. But on that, what would drive that? What folks don't understand really very much is that the big international oil companies, the Exxon Mobils, the Totals, the BPs, the Shells, Chevron, they're not really very big. ExxonMobil is actually about the 14th largest oil company in the world in terms of reserves, behind more than a dozen national oil companies. And they're significantly smaller. ExxonMobil controls less than 2% of the world's oil reserve. And if you take BP, Total, and Shell, and all the other large ones that people know, and put them all together, they control less than 10% of the world's conventional oil reserve. So access to oil is very difficult in many of these countries. Mexico doesn't allow it. Saudi, Venezuela has closed down, of course. Bolivia is following suit. So these companies are not going to want to go out of business, and we certainly need them to stay in business to provide energy. So there's a real resource driver and an economic driver for them to begin to look for some of these unconventional sources that are found in places that are open to exploration and production.
Hmm.
So that's happening right now, and you see some remarkable new technologies being developed to produce them, much of it in the subsurface. You never even see that surface production going on.
Hmm.
It's pretty exciting.
Well, I got a caller here I want to get right to. It seems that the answer to the question, when do these things become economically viable, obviously that's pegged to the price of conventional oil.
Yep.
So you have to ask, okay, at what price per barrel of conventional oil, how high does that have to get for us to be able to say it's economically reasonable? So we're already there.
And it's not so much a – it's not so much a price as it is a stability factor. The issue really is one of risk and price volatility. Mm-hmm. If you make an investment at X dollar price of the commodity and it falls dramatically after that, you lose a lot of money. And that's what happened in the 70s. As the price went up, shale oil and other things, we started looking at those, and then the price went down as the cartel released the reserves. That was a supply push, that price. Very different now. We're in a demand pull. So I think there's a lot more comfort in the industry that we've seen a new price floor. It'll still be volatile, but we've seen a floor. Most of these companies structured, and I was in the industry for 18 years, they structured their bottom lines around about $18 to $20 oil. And they lost staff accordingly and trimmed and put efficiencies in place. So the price is now up to a point where they can afford to do some of these things. It's a little more expensive, but the stability of owning your own resource and knowing where that next barrel, if you will, is going to come from is very attractive.
Hmm.
So I think we're there. I think you're seeing these investments being made. People know that it won't stay at 60, particularly if it's successful. It'll put new product on the market and push price back down a little bit, hopefully. But I think you're there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Line number one here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Are there any unexplored areas like, far away, South America? But also, how does one estimate reserves? Does oil send a sound wave back that's different? Because the books on oil say Hubbert had access to a lot of easy data, and in recent years, that's been treated as company secrets. The data is kept a secret.
Yeah, those are good questions. I'll take the first one first. The new unexplored areas are largely in the Arctic. That's the big new frontier that many countries are now looking at, the Arctic and the Arctic Circle region. The geology there is quite interesting. Of course, there's a huge challenge in terms of exploration, but that's one. And then we march ever deeper off the various coasts. The U.S. now is producing oil from 7,000 to 8,000 feet of water depth in the Gulf of Mexico and continues to go deeper. The minute you cross the border into Mexico, Mexico's in 500 meters or about 1,500 feet. So a whole frontier on the Mexico side that's never been explored, largely due to capital limits. But you see that, offshore West Africa, South America, a lot of offshore potential. And certainly Russia has big reserves. The Siberian Basin have been explored, but as you move further north, again, some areas that have limited. And I'll just mention one thing on that in terms of maturity of resource. In Texas, we have close to 1 million oil wells that have been drilled through over the last century. If you go south of the border into Mexico, it's in the tens of thousands total number of oil wells in the whole country. So we're a very mature province here, and people think of Mexico as mature as well, but that's a couple orders of magnitude different from what we have just across the border. So largely that's due to investment in capital. So I think the potential for further exploration, it probably won't push us to a conventional oil peak that's too much further out than now, but it'll certainly help with the sustaining of that. In terms of the technology just continues to improve. You mentioned sound waves. That's one way. We call that seismic data, is putting various sources of sound at the surface or in the subsurface and measuring the reflections. And yes, rocks sound travels through rocks pretty well, but there are little pore spaces in the rocks that are filled with either gas or oil or water, and we're beginning to get good enough data to be able to differentiate some of those things. Gas and water have a different sound or signal, so we've been able to see natural gas for a while, but getting even better with oil. So technology continues to improve, and I think one of the early questions was, how about peak oil? Mm-hmm. A lot of the folks who believe that it's here now and want it to see it sort of fall dramatically, they stop technology development today and they say, if we are where we are today, this is what will happen. But technology marches on, in all industries, and the oil industry is probably the highest technology business except for perhaps NASA in the world. The largest computers, the education, et cetera, it's a real, very high-tech and exciting global business. So when you're risking billions of dollars, you try to put all the science and engineering at it that you can. Yeah.
Well, other questions certainly are welcome here. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Scott Tinker. He's director of the Bureau of Economic Geology based at University of Texas at Austin. He is also the state geologist of Texas and is professor of geology at UT Austin. He's here visiting the campus, part of a series of talks and events that all mark the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. And I'm sure that in future weeks and months, we will have some more of the folks who are here to take part in this here on the program. Questions are certainly welcome. Five, let's talk with some other callers. We have someone here from Indiana on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like for you to get a little more hard-edged here. Do some talk with geopolitics and concern. I'm thinking about, as a subset, Iraq, certainly, a lot of people say that's all for oil control in the long run. But I'd like for you to talk about some of these other countries that haven't been embellished with the capitalistic spirit and soon will be from large corporations taking over. So wonder if you could talk about the geopolitics and all this and possibilities for small wars, big wars, or whatever kind of wars. Thanks.
All right. Is that question clear enough? I guess I hear that as being, you know, the possibility for continued and future conflict over this particular resource that we've been talking about here.
Yeah, and there's a great book by Daniel Yergin called The Prize, and Yergin runs a group called CIRA now, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, and it deals with the whole set of issues around oil and politics of oil and the wars, and I think history is always a good teacher. So we'd be a bit naive to think that anything that we're doing globally doesn't have some component of energy behind it. Energy is what our economy runs on, and it's what all economies will run on. So, you know, I don't have enough knowledge to talk about why we're in Iraq, but I feel comfortable part of that is there's oil reasons behind it as well as democratic reasons. If you look globally right now, there are some hot spots, certainly down in South America. General Chavez, who's the president of the country now, and has kind of closed some things down, nationalized, if you will, there. And there are several countries in Latin America that are looking to follow suit. Bolivia most recently. They had external investment in Bolivia, and there was a 15% tax. The largest investor was Petrobras from Brazil, but other publicly traded companies. And with the election of the new president, who came into power this year and got the groundswell of the people behind him, they've raised that to a 50% tax, just changed the contracts unilaterally. And you know, that's the kind of change that will drive investment away minimally, whether or not it actually incites wars, but certainly things like that can. It's kind of another reason why I think you'll see, and I hope we see, the greater pursuit of some of these unconventional resources that we've been talking about. You can find shale and coal and tar sands, and then if you think about natural gas, which is the growing fossil energy resource, there are lots of unconventional forms of that as well that are found where oil's not found. So the upside of that is it opens up countries around the world to produce the resource and supply, and it takes the control out of the hands of a cartel. Mm-hmm. And there could be a lot of positive economic impacts of that, and I think perhaps social and political impacts as well.
So you think that, I guess I asked this question knowing the answer, that in the future that natural gas is going to be even more important than it is now. Obviously, that doesn't really do anything for us with internal combustion engines. We still maybe have a problem there. How are we going to deal with transportation and all their different approaches that have potential there? But you think that is natural gas now an underutilized resource?
Well, it's interesting that natural gas has been slowly rising. If you look at the total consumption of energy in the world, I'll just give you these numbers. Oil accounts for about 44% of the world's energy supply, and coal and natural gas are tracking one another down in the 20s. Combined, the three represent 85% of the energy that we consume globally comes from those three sources. Oil has been declining about 2% every decade. Coal has been flat, and natural gas has been rising a couple percent every decade. So you see a transition from liquid forms to natural gas forms. The challenge of natural gas, which is being addressed, is it's not a physical global commodity right now because we don't move it around across hemispheres. Liquefied natural gas, which is what people have read and heard a lot about, is condensing gas into a liquid form by freezing it and moving it around on ships and then unfreezing it. And those shipping lanes are opening up as they permit and build new LNG terminals. We've permitted three new ones in Texas just this year. The U.S. only has four currently. So you're going to see, just like we did with oil, you'll see those international lanes open. natural gas will sort of seek a commodity stature there, and it continues to and will continue to slowly replace oil. There are vehicles that run on natural gas, various forms of it right now. It's just not something that manufacturers feel comfortable transitioning to. So it'll play an important role. Equally important will be the gasification of coal. So it turns out when you put a solid fuel into a hot thing that looks like a jet engine called a gasifier and feed a bunch of oxygen into it, you form a syngas, carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And you can burn those fuels to turn turbines and produce power. And then you can capture that emission and store it underground. And that's making coal clean. And the mm-hmm. president mentioned clean coal in his State of the Union, and that's the process he's describing. So we can be more intelligent now about how we use the solid resource of coal in terms of its end use. A lot more clean. So that's exciting. And I think you'll see, again, oil kind of having its heyday. Oil peaked in about 1981 globally at just under 50% of the world's energy it supplied. It's down, most folks don't know, to in the low 40% now and continues to decline. That's not Hubbard's peak. Call that whatever peak, Tinker's peak, but you know, that was the one that was a real interesting peak, is when oil had its highest point in terms of percentage energy consumption was in the early 80s, and we've been decreasing steadily since then.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We'll go to Rubano, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Today's Independent has an article about the Alberta tar sands, oil sands, and they mention that the Albertans are a bit right of center as it is in that province, and since next month they're going to be getting a check. Every Albertan's going to get a check of $400 Canadian as a prosperity check, kind of like what goes on in Alaska. They think in this article they're talking about how the oil sands, even right now, produce the most greenhouse gases in Canada, and that this whole thing threatens to have Canada drop its Kyoto commitments. Could you talk about if this alternative source of oil is exploited, just what it'll do to the environment? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
That's a real good question, I think, and point. Whenever you talk about energy use, there's always a net energy cost, and one of the things to produce the tar sands in Alberta that you have to do is heat them, and they're using natural gas to do that. So we import about 3 trillion cubic feet of natural gas every year from Canada, and that supply is at risk a little bit because the Canadians now need some of that to heat and then produce the oil sands. So there's a net energy cost there, and I'll talk to the environmental piece in just a second, but that's true of any form of energy, whether it's wind or solar. You know, you move wind turbines out on diesel trucks to their point, and you have manufacturing facilities and infrastructure you have to maintain. So whatever form of energy we talk about, there's net energy, what it takes to produce it, what it actually produces, and then what you can consume. The environmental aspects, each one has its own unique challenge, and I could talk across all energy forms, whether you're talking about dams or oil pump jacks or natural gas wells, which are sort of the least obtrusive on the surface. Wind turbines getting very large now and pretty dense farms, et cetera, solar panels, all have some visual cost to them and then the atmospheric cost. Oil sands, if you heat them and produce them and burn them as oil, we largely use oil in a combustion engine processes. That's what it's for, transportation for the most part, some heating oils. And that process currently produces atmospheric emissions. And we are slow to adapt to other things. It's expensive to make those changes, and I think we just need to be realistic about the length of time it's going to take to do that. So again, the actual production of those, there is some atmospheric component to that, but it's really the end use that we're talking about in combustion engines that puts out the emissions. An exciting part about that, and I go back to the question about methane and combine these, what you've heard of fuel cells and fuel cell technology, onboard fuel cells, the feedstock for that is methane. You put in methane is a simple molecule, CH4, one carbon and four hydrogens, and fuel cells essentially split the hydrogen off from that and use it. So you can use methane as a feedstock for some of the cars now, the technology that exists now for fuel cells. It's more about getting the infrastructure set up for distribution stations, the equivalent of gas stations, to supply those vehicles, and that'll give the automakers enough confidence to build cars that will use that. And unfortunately, it's a tight loop. Wow. One group says, we'll build the cars and we'll build the stations, and another, build the stations, we'll build the cars. So I think the incentives could be directed toward encouraging that to happen a little more quickly than it is. Environment is a huge issue whenever we're combusting fossil fuels. There's no doubt about it. The biggest emissions come from combusting solid fuels and then liquids. Natural gas is the least of the three. So, again, we can liquefy coal and gasify coal, and we can gasify oil. I think you'll see that progression as we go forward.
All right. Well, let's go on and talk with someone here now in another Urbana caller. This is line number two.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm calling, and this is in some way an extension of the worry about environmental pollutions. And I'm very concerned about the health of the oceans, particularly with oil spills, gas spills, the increased drilling for oil in the ocean bed and the dangers that that produces. I've heard several suggestions that the oceans are seriously in decline. And water, I think, ultimately is probably more important to the health of living forms on the planet than oil and gas, however much we want oil and gas to heat our homes and push our cars. Thanks.
All right. Well, can you comment on that?
Yeah, a good point. And oceans are a huge part of the world's ecosystem. So the last major oil spill in this country was Valdez, Alaska, and that was in the late 80s. There have been some small things since then, but, I would say that most folks probably don't recognize because it doesn't get reported often, and I'll thank you for, having this kind of a guest on, that the environmental record of the industry is quite good. If we were to sort of ground for example, air transportation fleet every time their airplane went down, none of us would fly anywhere. And so a 25-year record now of no major oil spill is not bad. It's not to say that it's catastrophic when it happens. We all recognize that. I think there's been improved technology for cleanups, but now and then you're going to have, when humans are involved, those kinds of accidents. It not a defense. It just is that way. And so, but I think in terms of ocean health, that is not a big driver. And I study reefs and limestone rocks is my background. So the reef health, there are other issues there, and you're exactly right. There are reefs dying out globally right now, and a lot of people are trying to make sure they understand why that is. Whitings is various kind of bleaching and things that go on. So some of it may be storms and silts that are blown across from the sub-Sahara. Some very interesting data out on that. Part of it is perhaps ocean temperatures. In the slow rise in ocean temperature, although things do adapt pretty well. So part of it may be other human activity, at least in proximity. And usually these things end up being a combination of factors. Reefs have also died out through time, long geologic time before man ever was here. So there are some natural earth processes that go on as well. when you talk about release of greenhouse gases, large volcano eruptions or even modest size are very large sources of that. Methane hydrates that melt can be large sources of natural gas going into the atmosphere that don't have human or anthropogenic components to them. So it's a complex system. I think anytime you read something, it may, you know, by default things get fairly simplified, and I think we do a disservice to each other when we say that. It's a complex system, and people are trying very hard to understand the different parameters and how they relate to one another. Researchers spend a lot of time doing that, and we know we never have exact answers, but I think we're getting closer to determining some of the issues and then try to deal with them.
We were talking a little bit earlier. You were talking about the increased potential for the use of natural gas and that being tied in some respect to the ability to transport it.
Mm-hmm.
And the move towards liquefying it and transporting it in big ships, which means so you got to have a terminal on one side to liquefy it. You load it on the ship goes to a terminal someplace else. You deliquefy it, and then you got your gas, and you could put it into the pipeline and pipe it around like usual.
You got it.
And and you mentioned the fact that we don't have many of these terminals here, and I think one of the reason is that they make people really nervous. They're concerned about safety, and that I suppose is in a sense an environmental issue that you wouldn't want to live next to one. Is how much concern is there about safety when you're talking about liquefied natural gas and having one of these big kinds of terminals that a ship. I guess the way I think about it is that it's kind of like a big floating bomb.
Yeah.
Now, maybe it's really not that dangerous, but I know that there is that concern.
Yeah, that's a good question. They're not floating bombs, although one that's not been tested, but it's certainly been simulated. They're dual-hulled ships that have liquefied methane on them. Simulations show, and I hope we never test this, although, well, you know, if you like the movies, Syriana had somebody run a boat with a missile on it threw it into an LNG tanker, and you didn't see what happened, but the perception was it blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's probably not what happens. They're kind of like a flash and flare is what the simulations show, that you would flood the surface of the ocean in the nearby vicinity with liquefied natural gas, and it could combust, and it would sort of burn itself up. In that sense, the damage would be instant, but a lot less than an oil spill.
Mm-hmm.
Although if that ran out over populated areas, it'd be a real mess. And so that's why the applications now are looking to bring them in 20 miles offshore and then pipe it in as natural gas from there, and that makes some good sense then. So the ship itself is probably actually more safe than an oil tanker. And the receiving terminals are probably more safe than some of the receiving oil terminals if that is an issue. It's a natural public reaction that anything that's different or new we haven't had before, so we don't want it. But a lot of folks live with refining processes, petrochemical plants, power utilities, and receiving terminals all over the world currently, and this is just a different form of one. That may, in fact, be a little bit more safe than some that we've lived with for many years.
Okay. Well, yeah. Let's. We'll just keep on. We'll at least get one more caller in, maybe more, depending on how we do here on
time. I'd like to issue a challenge, if I could. I'm up here from Texas, and I listen to public radio down there all the time, and sometimes I'm frustrated that the balanced view isn't always there, so I'm going to issue a challenge. I will match the first $100 that calls in with my own personal pledge for your program.
What a guy.
if a Texan can contribute, somebody from around here must be able to.
Well, I appreciate that very much. You folks are listening. You can take that. You can just take that to the bank and bring us some of the money. Let's go on. We'll talk with someone here on cell phone. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was listening to some of the comments about how long these sources of energy and so on are going to be lasting and not hearing any real answers. But I think the fact is that over generations, these alternative sources of energy that you're mentioning are not going to be sustainable, and they're also not going to be healthy. I don't think that you would want to live next door to some of those plants, and I don't think that anybody's going to be happy about living downwind from them. My question is, do you and the people that you work with ever visualize a prosperous world in which petroleum products aren't at the center? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. That's a good question. I do live next to them because Texas produces a lot of energy for the country, so most of us live by those sources. And I absolutely envision a world and the sooner the better. You know, I would say we will probably look back someday and say, why did we combust fossil fuels? Just like we look back and say, why did we burn coal and wood and hay? But that's kind of the decarbonization of the energy that has been going on predictably for a couple hundred years now. So we've gone from coal and wood and hay, which is all carbon, to oil, which is a hydrocarbon, to methane, which is more hydrogen in it than carbon, and then eventually to other forms that are either hydrogen-dominated. The only sustainable source of energy in the world, the only truly sustainable one, is the sun. And everything else, there's no other renewable source. That's an oxymoron. Energy is not renewable. But the sun probably has a longer life than anything we know about, and when it's not around, we may have a different issue on our hands. So I think solar is really the thing that we need to be looking hard at, and it's going to take a tremendous investment, both of capital and brain power, a good partnership between governments and universities and industry to do that. And it's going on at a scale now that's okay, but I think we could really ramp that up, and the sooner the better. You said you hadn't heard answers. I'll try to provide some thought here, because we have what we have globally right now, and the cost of the infrastructure for energy is a phenomenal number. So to replace it is going to take a long time. No matter how quick we want to replace it, the reality is it'll take a while to replace that infrastructure. And if we do it in a way that mandates things that are not doable, and one caller mentioned earlier that Canada wasn't able to live up to Kyoto. Actually, almost all the countries aren't able to live up to it because they haven't been able to make the investments required to meet those mandated caps. And if we mandate things that we can't do, one, then it becomes sort of a problem. And if we try to do them and the economy can't react, if you want to hurt the environment, throw the world into a global recession. And you'll see very few dollars spent on the environment, because people won't be targeting money toward that. They'll be targeting it toward recession spending. And so as hard as it may be to cross this bridge from today to tomorrow's energy, we need to be fairly realistic about how long that will take and what kinds of forms make better sense today than the ones we've been using in the past. So that's why I do support transition from solid and liquids to natural gases. That's a good bridge fuel. It's cleaner. It's not as clean as some other forms, but it's a realistic bridge as we go towards some of the things that can replace that on a scale that we're talking about. It's very hard to conceptualize for most folks the amount of energy we consume. It's a remarkable amount of energy. So when we start talking about scales of things, I could talk to you about each energy form to produce a fifth of the U.S. energy demand in wind or solar or hydro or hydrothermal. It's an infrastructure that is kind of hard to fathom. So I appreciate, I think what you're implying with your question is how soon can we get there? Trust me, there's nobody that I know that doesn't want to make that happen. It's just a matter of the process of how to do it in a way that will keep the economy healthy enough that it can continue to invest in the process.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. I wish we could keep going. But we'll have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. And I promise also for people who are listening that we will continue on future programs to talk about energy. We have done that quite a bit on the show. Last summer we did a number of programs with different people talking about different sorts of renewables. We've had people here talking sort of representing the industry perspective. We've talked about from all kinds of perspectives because we think that that's important, and we will keep doing that. So you can rely on the fact that in the future here, we'll continue to have people on to talk about these subjects. Now, for the moment, though, we want to say thanks to our guest, Scott Tinker. He is director of the Bureau of Economic Geology based at University of Texas at Austin. He's professor of geology there and is also the state geologist of Texas. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.